So welcome again to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. I have my trusty co-host, Jim Thompson. Jim, how are you doing today?
Hey, Alex. Good to be back.
And we have a guest host today, Larry King, whom I met at the Dallas Fantasy Fair. And we actually did a Jack Kirby panel together. Larry King, introduce yourselves to everybody.
Hello, boys. Well, I'm Larry W. King. I'm here in Denton, Texas. In the case of the Dallas Fantasy Fair, I had a long association with that organization and the programmer, Larry Langford, who's no longer with us now. My background has been pretty much in radio and song production, and certainly was bitten by the comics bug, and really, you know, the 20th century pop culture at a pretty early age. You know, I really like you guys. I have listened to your podcast and enjoy your Facebook pages, and man, it's really on a high level. I mean, I think it's very conversational, but you guys are real scholars, so I'm going to enjoy chatting
with you. Thanks, Larry. That's nice. Well, that's great.
Alex,
well,
can I ask David a just one quick question?
Sure.
Just point out.
You can call me David.
Larry.
Did I call you Larry?
No, his name is Larry. You wanted to call him David for some reason.
Well, I know why. So, Larry, do you ever get, because Alex, you're the only one of us now that is not probably constantly said, oh, I really like your work, ha, 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 because I'm Jim Thompson, meaning the author of many, yes, many hard-edged novels, and you are Larry King. So, Alex, do you feel deprived that you're not actually a famous person like we are?
That's right. There is no famous person for me to be confused with. I can't camouflage my way into any situations based on my very neutral name.
Which is nice, because it really gets old to be like,
oh
yes, I know your work. You're on CNN. You're old as shit. You know, that kind of thing. You get that, Larry?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Well, you know, yes, but the thing for me now is that the young people that I work with, they don't know who he is. That finally in my life, he's now, you know, an anachronism, and they don't know. So I'm coming out of that whole idea. You got the same name as that guy. But, you know, because I was a DJ, I mean, even with my Brian Wilson interview, which is on YouTube, it's like, I would say, I'm not the CNN guy. I'm the rock and roll Larry King.
Ah, yeah, nice.
And there are lots of people with that name. I think the guy that wrote The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, is named Larry King. You know,
that's a good one.
Very common name. So I like when I meet people, you know, with Larry, it's like, hey, we got to stick together, you know? So there's like a fraternity of Larry. So I'm good with it. It was my dad's name. That guy on CNN, that's not his real name.
And you say Larry W. King, don't you? You don't necessarily say Larry. You say Larry W. King. That's the distinction.
I mean, I try to, because, you know, moving forward, and if I'm going to do any broadcasting or whatever, I want to use my own name. I don't want to use a stage name or anything like that. So, yeah, I tend to say that. My middle name is Wayne, and there's also a fraternity of men with the middle name of Wayne. You know, it's statistically the top choice of middle name for serial killers, you know, John Wayne Gacy, Elmer Wayne Henley, you know. So even more so than the Club of Larrys is the fraternity of men with the middle name of Wayne.
Right. So today what we're doing is
I would take all of this out. Anyway.
it's what we live for.
All right. That's
we live for these moments. If they're moments of humanity, Larry, that's what we're all about here at the Comic Book Historian Podcast.
If you could put like podcast. Some reverb. Anyway.
So basically today what we're doing is talking about various archival works in comic history, various ways of presenting archival material, as well as discussing archival material in comic book history books that in some way contribute to our understanding of comic book history in general. Each one of us is talking about a different topic today, which will be really fascinating. I'm going to start off. I know you guys are ready to go too. I've always been a proponent of understanding that the pulp history of magazines is a direct contributor to the genesis of the comic books, especially the golden age of comic books. And a lot of those golden age comics take their cues from the pulp magazines, a lot of the substance, the material. And we've talked about that a lot, like Doc Savage was a progenitor of Superman and The Shadow was a progenitor to Batman, etc. But it goes deeper than that. Even after the golden age of comics, a lot of the material was still being obtained from pulp magazines and science fiction digests that were concurrently being published. So what I did was I read a book called Astounding by Alec Navalli Lee, which discusses the golden age of science fiction in the 20th century, centered around four interesting men who were essentially the backbones of 20th century science fiction. Isaac Asimov, who we all know from his Foundation series and his robot artificial intelligence books, and Robert Heinlein, who wrote books like Starship Troopers, and L. Ron Hubbard, who wrote a lot of science fiction in the 30s and 40s before creating Dianetics, and John W. Campbell Jr., who was the editor of Astounding Science Fiction magazine that started around the late 1930s, like 38 or 39 or so. And what it does, this book, is it talks about the four guys, their early childhoods, their weird relationships with their parents, right, how a couple of them entered the military, and then they all around the same time started to submit work to Astounding Science Fiction magazine. John W. Campbell Jr. ended up starting his work as editor of Astounding, which was owned by Street & Smith at the time. And when he became editor, he started having this knack of understanding which books are really pertinent to that historical time. And he essentially molded people like Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and L. Ron Hubbard to an extent to try to get the best out of these guys by saying, you know, I like this draft, but I wanted to have a little more of this. I like that draft, but I wanted to have a little more of that. And then he'd send them back and they'd send it back to him. And essentially these four men, when they intersect, they start fomenting a lot of ideas and bouncing ideas off each other. And it just explodes in the science fiction magazines. What's interesting is the world's first science fiction convention in 1939 in New York, a lot of comic book conventions still model themselves after that first science fiction convention that happened in the late 30s. Even Superman was created in a science fiction background and an alien on Earth. A lot of that came from Siegel and Shuster reading science fiction pulp magazines. So there is a relationship. But what's cool is where these guys go after that. So in World War II, Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein, L. Sprague de Camp, who wrote a lot of Conan stuff, they actually served in the military at a Navy yard, and they have really interesting time in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, just kind of researching, you know, chemistry and trying to bounce some ideas off. It was kind of boring, but once the war was over, each one kind of goes their own way, but still submitting books to Astounding. And what's really interesting is Isaac Asimov really starts exploding with his science fiction in the late 40s, early 50s, and so does Robert Heinlein. I don't know if you guys know much about Robert Heinlein, but in 1959, he wrote Starship Troopers, which was him shifting mentally from being kind of a left-wing socialist to more of a right-wing, hyper-militaristic right-wing guy. And that shift existentially is manifested in his Starship Troopers book in 1959. So he became a huge Barry Goldwater fan and felt like some of the later guys like Ronald Reagan were not right-wing enough for him. L. Ron Hubbard, which was really a really fascinating story. Jim loves L. Ron Hubbard. He, but basically after he was the only one of the four guys who actually be in the military at in combat. Although he didn't actually see direct combat, he was the closest of all of them. So the other three guys completely worshipped L. Ron Hubbard and thought, man, this guy's like a real adventurer. What's interesting is after war, though, he had some post-traumatic stress. It didn't work out quite the way he wanted. He had some medical problems. And he starts experimenting with the Aleister Crowley crowd and some cult stuff and trying to experiencing into the occult. And there are some interesting stories of Robert Heinlein and some of the guys like kind of sleeping with each other's wives, kind of. And actually, there's a lot of some group sex stuff kind of happening, which was really fascinating to see.
I think I need to pick another book.
But what's interesting is psychologically, they kind of go through what L. Ron Hubbard was going through in the 40s, where it manifests in him self-actualizing himself out of that kind of depressive funk. And through that, he came up with the Dianetics idea of self-auditing and becoming clear. And that was happening as these science fiction books were all genesising around the same time. So it becomes this really interesting thing where the first appearance of Dianetics was in John W. Campbell's Astounding Science Fiction magazine in May 1950. It came out in that magazine before it came up with the Dianetics book 6 months or so later. So it's actually a science fiction manifesto in the beginning, but with true psychological ramifications. There is a whole chapter devoted to how John W. Campbell Jr. and L. Ron Hubbard essentially synergized the initial Dianetics form. But what was really fascinating about that relationship was how guys like A.E. Van Vogt, who there have been 70s science fiction magazines that have comic book versions of A.E. Van Vogt stuff, A.E. Van Vogt was also in the initial Dianetics movement And so all these guys are they're balancing philosophy and the cybernetics of the human mind all in this time. And this would then reflect on some of their work later on that then made comic books later. There's a big blowout. L. Ron Hubbard goes off to create Dianetics, his own version of it, and then Scientology. Then the other guys went off just to work in science fiction in general. And a lot of the concepts of Dianetics and Scientology was making it into their science fiction stuff, too. So this evolution of these guys was just really fascinating from beginning to end. Also, another thing is Isaac Asimov. Did you know he had AIDS?
Yes, I
did not know that.
Yeah, he had AIDS. He caught it from a blood transfusion in 1983 from a heart surgery, and it essentially just wrecked his life all the way up to when he died in 1992. But through that time, with no physical energy, he still hammered out book after book after book, ideas about artificial intelligence and alien stories and things. And so what's fascinating to me is how when these books were huge pop cultural relevant phenomena at the time, comic book writers are reading this stuff and then putting some of these concepts into the comic book. So at any rate, it's a really worthy book, Astounding by Alec Navalli Lee. It's about 450 pages, but it's a real ride. I was really blown away by it.
Yep. If Ron L. Hubbard wasn't part of this conversation, it would be easier for me to talk about this because I don't think he's the same thing as Asimov is a real hero of mine. And he's not just a science fiction writer, but he wrote about everything. I mean, he wrote as a scientist. He wrote as a historian. I have his books on Greek mythology, and he goes through all of those stories. He's just a really fascinating Da Vinci kind of a style guy. He is a man of
absolutely,
every
yeah.
talent. And the Foundation books are some of my favorite science fiction, even though they don't have a lot of characterization in them necessarily.
And I think Asimov was also like a face of science fiction to the general public, where those other guys were not. I mean, you know, L. Ron Hubbard maybe, but, you know, Asimov was a television figure. He helped to save Star Trek and stuff like that. In his battle with AIDS, you know, to be a guy with AIDS and whatever in 1983, you know, you were on a short list, kind of. So he popularized the culture by being a guy that you would see in magazines and such.
Right. Yeah, he had that Asimov science fiction magazine that started in 78 or so, and his picture is right there with the logo or with the lettering of the titling, and he was a huge figure.
He was the Hitchcock of science fiction, and that he was not just because he had that persona. You knew what he looked like that you did about Hitchcock in terms of suspense thrillers.
What's really fascinating that you guys mentioned, single out Asimov, he was the one that was actually the only one that was actually a true scientist, which is interesting. He was the one that actually had a degree in science, where he was a true biochemist. He actually did science research and wrote nonfiction science books and textbooks. And he was faculty. He was actually a faculty member. The other three guys were not. And what's interesting is they distinguish that here as he came from a genuine place, whereas the other guys that are science fiction writers, they came from a speculative place. They really note that there is a psychological difference there, that the speculative types, they start believing things that aren't real true. So John W. Campbell, although he left, you know, Dianetics, and he and his wife would still audit each other for decades after he left Dianetics, by the way. But he would also start believing in contraptions that didn't really ever work. And he would invest his money in other people's contraptions because he thought that the government was suppressing research and he was believing these really cockamamie things. And Asimov would just roll his eyes to this stuff saying, this is just completely ridiculous what you're saying here. And Robert Heinlein, as he got older, he became less in touch with the science aspect of the science fiction and more into his politicizing about things. Whereas Asimov is the one that actually truly stayed scientific from beginning to end. He was the true scientist of the four. He was always, always saying dirty jokes left and right, and always against women's will, was always pinching their butts, slapping their butts, over and over and over and over again, to a point where he was actually talked to about this and people accepted it like, well, that's just Isaac, you know. And even Harlan Ellison was actually shocked by this behavior, where everyone started getting very uncomfortable with introducing him to a female friend of theirs because he was always slapping their butts, pitching their butts, and like chasing them up the stairs and acting truly, he was the dirty old man. He was the dirty old man on campus, actually. The dirty old man on campus. So
Heinlein is interesting, though, in what you talked about, the politicization, because his book, Stranger in a Strange Land, was probably embraced by the left
and the hippies.
And the hippies more. I mean, the word grok was such an expression of those people who right. would have found his actual politics to be abhorrent. But they didn't know him.
Right.
They just knew what that book was about in terms of free love. And interestingly, I think a form of a cult that comes from that, you can trace back to what Hubbard ends up doing. And
right.
in fact, even Asimov with Harry Seldon becomes a cult figure. So they all do have this notion of following a questionable leader.
Right. And what's interesting is they get ideas from each other. So I don't want to get too much into the details of Scientology and Dianetics, because I know that that's very personal for some people, but that whole aspect of a federation built on human sanity and saving the world from itself and its faults, you know, that aspect makes it into a lot of science fiction. Star Trek has that. The Galactic Republic of Star Wars was about that. So I find that really interesting. Also, the atomic bomb was a huge influence on John W. Campbell, and he would guide a lot of the writers to focus his writing around the atomic bomb. He and L. Ron Hubbard felt that Dianetics was the way to use science fiction and critical thinking to save humanity from the bomb, to evolve humans to match the technology that was coming out. And he would put that into his science fiction as well. So this was really interesting. Also, there were some books that they would talk about that, you know, the EC Comics was directly copying a lot of these books in the 50s. That Wally Wood drawn story about the girl that was a stowaway on the ship, and they only had a limited amount of oxygen to get and food to get the people from A to B. So what did they do? They threw the girl out the airlock, right? And that was in a Wally Wood drawn story. And what's funny is the original story, John W. Campbell was the editor. And when he got that story sent to him, he kept sending it back to the writer until they threw the girl out the airlock in the original story. John W. Campbell was like, why would you save the girl if there's not enough resources? Here, I'm going to send this back to you. Send it back to me until she's dead. And so they finally killed her off, and then he published it, which I found was interesting. They do go through Frank Herbert actually released Dune in Astounding Science Fiction when it was renamed into Analog Science Fiction. And John W. Campbell was the one that published Dune. And he kept publishing it until he didn't like where Frank Herbert was taking Paul Atreides. And so then Frank Herbert then took that chapter to somewhere else. But Dune actually premiered in this as well. So
in the case of EC, they pirated mm-hmm. some of that stuff until, like, Bradbury says, you know, that's mine. And then they made a gentleman's agreement.
I
mean, it's not
the Bradbury stuff. Yes, they did.
They weren't proactive about it, but it still worked out, I guess.
Right.
Alex, does the book talk about illustrators at all? Since that's one of the comic aspects is that crossover with the illustrations of those books.
Now, I would say this book focuses more on the stories and a lot of the stories were taken from the comic people and the illustrators, but they didn't really focus on illustrations. They do talk about Harry Harrison in this book, though, who was Wally Wood's collaborator in 1950. As they joined EC Comics together. And they also talk about Forrest Ackerman. Forrest Ackerman, I don't know if you guys know this, he was a big science fiction fan guy from the late
30s. He created the word. He takes credit for creating the word science fiction.
So then Forrest Ackerman, who actually co-created one of the early science fiction fanzines with Mort Weisinger and Julia Schwartz, whom are also mentioned in the book, they talk about him and their involvement with science fiction and Julia Schwartz and Mort Weisinger being pulp agents for some of these writers. They do also mention that Forrest Ackerman was actually present in that first year and a half of Dianetics as well with L. Ron Hubbard and John W. Campbell Jr. and A.E. Van Vogt. So I found that was really interesting because we associate Forrest Ackerman with the famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, not necessarily this other stuff. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Hey, I went to the Acker Mansion in August of 01 mm-hmm. and was Forrest's guest. And whatever Acker Mansion was there, I think it was a big Acker Mansion. I think he downsized after we were there. But yeah, you know, Forey was one of those first fans. And just imagine if you're this kid and you're going up to like whatever Willis O'Brien and says, you know, can I have your scraps from King Kong, you know, and this kind of stuff that he was on the scene at that time period, you know, that you could approach all these people. I mean, it's amazing. Again, it's the idea that as younger people, we can't imagine that somebody was cool enough to do it before we did. But
right.
But yeah, Julie Schwartz and Mort and Bory and maybe Bradbury maybe in. There's a whole bunch of guys in that clique. And when you see Forey from that time period, Forey's like dressed like Buck Rogers or whatever. Forey's like the original cosplay guy.
Right.
And he's always, and I'm going to use this word today a lot, jodhpurs, is that right? You know, those crazy pants. We'll talk about more characters wearing those pants. But anyway, and who knows how Forey got some of those things in his collection. I mean, I love Forey, but he's the guy. He was the fanboy archetype.
Right. Yeah, it was always great at San Diego Comic-Con to see Forey, Harryhausen, and Bradbury all on stage, sometimes joined by Julius Schwartz as well. But that was always so much fun to listen to all of them. They used to do this at in Los Angeles when they would show Harryhausen films, too. They would all come to it and be on for Q's and A's. It's a real passing to see all those guys.
I met a lot of those guys. I knew Harryhausen a little bit, good guy, and Julie and I were good friends, so maybe a couple more of those guys. But I love that, you know, a wonderful group of men, the fact that they all got together and collaborated at that time, you know.
Yeah, and one last thing, John W. Campbell Jr., I don't know if you guys know this, but he wrote the original story that they based the John Carpenter 1982 movie The Thing on. That was John W. Campbell Jr.
Wait, you're talking about the John Carpenter film, but you got to go back and talk about Howard Hawks' Richard Nyby film. I mean, that was a remake.
Yeah, that was right. And you're talking about the 1951 one that Ray Harryhausen.
What's the story? Is it Foghorn or who goes there? That the thing is based on? Is that who goes there? Anyway.
Yep.
Who goes there? That's right.
Right. Okay.
All right. Well, now, Larry, let's hear what you have to say about tell the audience which book you picked.
Okay. Well, you know, Alex and I had a conversation about this initially, and the book that I brought is by the author Jules Feiffer, and it's called The Great Comic Book Heroes. And so Feiffer was born in about 29. He became a assistant to Will Eisner at the age of 17. And, you know, he went on to, he's an interesting guy to write a book on the comic history because he's such an accomplished guy himself. He's sort of a guy that's, you know, a scholarly guy, and he's looking at comics a little bit like it's, you know, a pulp thing or sort of a lesser work, I guess. You know, Feiffer himself is a member of the Comic Book Hall of Fame, you know, looking that up. And he wrote many movies. He wrote Carnal Knowledge, Phantom Tollbooth, you know, so he's a very accomplished cartoonist and screenwriter. And, you know, I think Wikipedia says he was like the most popular satirist in the 60s. He's an editorial cartoonist. So, you know, he certainly has the cred to be writing this kind of thing. This book was originally published in 1965, so it's described as one of the first comic book histories. I don't know when Richard Lupoff wrote All in Color for Dime, you know, or some other books that might be available. The other comic book history I had as a kid was called Comics, I think, by maybe Les Daniels. I think so.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has like a lot of sort of smutty stuff in the back of it. So as a little kid, I had to rip those pages out so mom and dad wouldn't take the book out of my library, you know. But so anyway, you know, for kids that were interested in comics at that time, there were seemingly limited resources. Whereas this book, this Feiffer book, you guys, and again, it depends on like how old you are. I was born in 1962 and got interested in comics at about a 10-year-old about 72. And so my friend discovered, you know, the magic of remaindered books. And, you know, the books that you bought were dependent on how cheap they were, okay? And they were wonderful books, Chester Gould books, Little Orphan Annie books, and wonderful books that you could just buy for pennies. You know, there's a great Buck Rogers book from that era. But the cheapest of them all, the most ubiquitous, the book that you saw everywhere was The Great Comic Book Heroes by Jules Feiffer. And if you guys ever seen the cover of this book with this sort of, it's sort of like a Joe Shuster or Superman illustration, but it's sort of like they've done a Roy Lichtenstein on it or something kind of. You know, because there's like Bendy dots, you know, and that kind of thing.
Right.
I can remember when the mall opened in my town of Beaumont, Texas in about 1974. And you walked in and there was a bookstore. And on there was a table full of The Great Comic Book Heroes by Jules Feiffer with a honking, flashing red 50-cent or a dollar sticker on it, defacing the cover forever, you know. So for years, if you went into a bookstore, you would see this book, The Great Comic Book Heroes by Jules Feiffer. The book has an, I don't know if you want you want to call it an essay or a text by Feiffer that's about 75 pages long. Then, wonder of wonders, it's full of golden age comic book reprints. And at that time, for us to see a glimpse of Captain Marvel when it was, he was, you know, not in publication or a Plastic Man or things like that, this was a very important book, you know, to people of this era. And you can look in this book and, like, I don't know, this is like the 16th pressing of it or something. So, you know, culturally, it's interesting, I think, about this book. It, a lot of people had to have owned it. So it is a story of the beginning of the comics industry. You know, Feiffer says that he was at the right age for to get slammed by the Depression and, you know, all these things that were happening at that age. And the origin of comic books. And I'm interested in, like, pre-comic comics. Like, you know, if Superman is 1938, well, if you watch, let's say, if you're a fan of, like, the Little Rascals or Our Gang, and you see Spanky, and it's 1932 or something, and there's a magazine in the comic, or if it's a Popeye short, and Popeye's, there's Popeye books, you know? So there were these books, you know, that existed pre-comics. Feiffer was a guy that was there to read the first comics. Like, for instance, Famous Fantasy number one. I mean, we all know that cover, but, you know, you ever really thought about what was inside of Famous Fantasy number one? And Famous Funnies is actually the book. I'm trying to say Famous Funnies number one. So Feiffer talks about these books, you know, that they were publishing DC, that they were lame, you know, that whatever. The major premise of Jules Feiffer book, he put forward in 1964 some tropes about comic books. And really, the question was whether his premise is still where things are at today. And, you know, initially, guys, I thought that maybe we were, I thought we were all doing the same book, but never mind. You, have you guys read this book, this Feiffer book?
I have it in my hand right now. I read it the same. I'm 59. I had the same experience as you. Got it at Walden's Books, I think for a dollar, maybe. And it was my first book on comics, but the Les Daniels yellow comics book that has the underground stuff was around the same time that I bought this. And those two books were it for me in terms of realizing there was something,
and
a history to
it. In some degrees, it was it because you couldn't find any other ones. There was no internet, you know.
No, I got Serenko's book eventually, but yeah, it was hard.
And, you know, my comment about our friend James Steranko is, you know, his books were always expensive in that time period. History of the Comics by Steranko didn't go remaindered. That's why as a child, I couldn't buy it, where this book was like a dollar. So, Jim, you read this book, and the premise, I think, one of the premises of Feiffer is that, of course, newspaper cartoonists were the bomb. They were the greatest. And the guys that drew comics in 1935, 36, 37 did not had the talent, they were inferior to the newspaper strips. And that's sort of an old argument, you know? And it's certainly, if you're talking about, you know, literally before the good artists came in, you know, there's a, certainly an era of comics where anything, some guys would publish anything, Gleason, you know, or whatever. So anyway, that's his premise, that the newspaper strips are inherently better. And then I think the other premise is that pretty much everything is a swipe. You know, I mean, when you talk about, like, who created what and so forth, that pretty much all of those, you know, heroes were amalgamations of literary precursors.
There's a couple of things I would say on that. I think he's kinder to his old boss Eisner than to say he thought he was inferior. I think he gave Eisner a lot of credit in the spirit section of this book about his innovations.
Well, and yes, Eisner was his mentor. But one of the things about Feiffer is you can look in the indicia, if I'm using the word right, and you can see that Bob Kane helped him and Jerry Robinson helped him. And these guys, you know, Kane didn't necessarily have the bad reputation in 1965. You know, he was creating the Batman TV series. He was a Hollywood guy. He was a star. Right. So you can see who Pfeiffer's
getting his info from?
Yeah. I mean, for him to praise Bob Kane, give me a break. Give me a break. You know, I mean, but what he said is actually very accurate. It's just, I don't think Kane did it. He just swiped it from, you know, books. We can actually find the books that Kane swiped from, you know. But anyway, just like...
Yeah, it's touched on something I was going to add is that when this came out in 1965, superheroes were... There was a mainstream consciousness or curiosity about superheroes. So, you know, the Batman TV show was about to explode in 66. Yeah. And so there was demand for people to learn more about the superhero. So although this book was almost kind of like a curmudgeon-y kind of approach to more the older comic superheroes and, you know, how much value they're worth or how much value they have, I think that the book publishers were really ready to mass produce this book and sell it because the public wanted to know about superheroes and their origins. There are some other things also, as some people have noted, that was the one way you could actually get reprints of those Golden Age comics was through that book, because it wasn't like you had digital stuff online that you could just research and just find that stuff. So it was a good source for reprints as well.
I didn't mean to talk over you, but you know, the collector's market in most cities was so undeveloped. But if you lived in a great place, like, you know, if you were like Billy Mumy and you were buying at the, you know, Hollywood Poster store or something, I mean, you know, some guys had like awesome bookstores. There was one in Dallas that had everything, and it was like a late 80s, early 90s thing. You could go in there and, you know, there was a stack of Wiz comics this guy turned me on to, and he wanted me to buy them for him. I was like, I'm going to buy them all up, dude. You know, occasionally you find these oases of books. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, Captain Marvel, forget about it. We never saw, like, books from the 50s at the used bookstore, you know? I mean, you might see some 60s books. But I never saw books from the 40s. I mean, not to say there might not be here and there. But, you know, Plastic Man. So let me jump back into the actual book. Is that all right? So anyway, so you have this essay by Pfeiffer, and I think it's a really relevant book for you to read. I think the last time I saw this book in a bookstore, it didn't have the Golden Age comics anymore. I think I saw an actual edition of it that was just Pfeiffer's essay. Like,
That's right.
What's the point? But anyway, so, you know, looking through what we have here in this, there's a Superman origin story, which is very, you know, iconic. You know, the doctor says, what the? He's trying to inoculate Superman, and Superman says, try again, doc. And see, to me, comics is all about that. You know, Superman getting struck by lightning. It tickles, you know. Gentlemen, Krypton is doomed. I mean, I really like the thick-headedness of it. You know, I'm not really interested in... where whatever kind of continuity crazy stories are doing today. I mean, look, here's Superman racing a train, for God's sake. And you know, one of the things I wonder about you guys, so I wondered about this doctor, and he's trying to inoculate Superman, and it looks like the doctor holds in his hand like a hat pin. Is this censored art? In 1938, was he holding a hypo in his hand? You know, right. I mean, because you read these old books and you say, like, well, why does Detective 27 look like that? Oh, that, you know, many of these pages were censored, and it's hard to see them sometimes, you know, when they have hypodermic needles and things like that, you know, that they ultimately had to take out. So, Jim, maybe you can look in the front of the book and see what this Superman story is that we're looking at. But it's a wonderful, I guess, Joe Shuster story. You can tell me if that's the case. And the thing about what Pfeiffer says about Shuster is that he says that it's all about the design. And, you know, I'm interested in art that's coded, you know, like Pablo Picasso coded his work. You know what I'm saying? And so when I look at this Shuster artwork, to me, it's all right there for you visually. You know what I'm saying? It's just the storytelling seems so clear to me. But I'm sure a lot of people find Shuster to be an ugly artist. To me, I'm just a big fan. So that just puts me out of step with, you know, whatever, any Barry Windsor Smith fan, you know, whatever, because I love this Golden Age artwork. Right. You know?
And Pfeiffer's on board with this, too. He gets it. He talks about, even while he's being critical of the early pre-superhero ones, like Hickey, when he gets to him, he's like, yeah, this is the real thing. There's an action to this, and nobody does skyscrapers the same weird way that he does. He's appreciative of the art, I would say, in this when he talks about Shuster.
Well, in the case of Superman, it's almost like, and I'm going to use some terms, and if I'm wrong, correct me, because I say this all the time, but it's like it's in the public unconsciousness or in the zeitgeist, if you will, that when Superman came out in 1938, part of the premises is that the Times created Superman, you know, that when people saw Action Comics number one, they said, yes, that guy, you know, right. What I'm saying? I mean, there was a need for him, you know, in 1938. And, you know, that's a revenge. This is a revenge story here by Jerry Siegel. You know what I mean? Superman. He was a guy, he was a vigilante, and he was going to come out and he was going to punch you in the nose.
Well, in the chapter, on the Superman chapter, he actually says, Pfeiffer says that our reaction was less our original than, but of course, because right. Superman was an obvious thing to have happened at this point.
And then, so then you have some artwork when you get to the Joker's origin. Is that mainly Jerry Robinson art on that story?
I would think so. And I wanted to mention, Pfeiffer thanks Jerry Robinson above everybody else in the acknowledgement. So he did, whereas he talked to Kane and Eisner and everybody, Robinson gave him an awful lot of material on this.
You know, but I'll tell you another thing, though, is as much as he gives Bob Kane a pass, he says that Superman is the real thing. And he's pretty critical of Batman, the idea that you got to put on, you know, your bad underwear, you know, all that. He says all Superman has to do is get up in the morning.
Yeah, it's a good line. And in fact, talking about Superman for one more second, two things. The choice that he picked for the piece is interesting. The locomotive flood story, because so much of that early Superman is Superman being anti-establishment and fighting for justice, meaning beating up wife beaters or taking on the city establishment or the mining industry or other things, a social justice kind of an aspect to it. And he
definitely
picks
a vigilante.
He picks a story that doesn't have that, that's him against the environment. And it's interesting that that's the one that he picked. He doesn't talk in the preface at all about that aspect, the social aspect of Superman in those early pre-World War II days. And
you know, the reprint.
But, you know, it's funny. It's
matched the text.
Right. And also something that I've noticed about, I remember Jim and I have talked about this, but I look at before Whitney Ellsworth comes in to kind of sterilize Superman to make it more kid friendly in 1941-ish, those early Supermans did not read like, I felt it was more like the word you're using, vigilante, almost more like the Punisher, where he didn't care if the bad guy lived or died based on his intervention. And he wasn't just going against coal miners. He was also going against corrupt public institutions as well that were like these government funded institutions. He's also going against like corrupt publicly funded orphanages and corrupt mayors and things like that. So I don't know. I would say that he was basically that. I think he started out as the id of Jerry Siegel. What Jerry Siegel, angry and pissed off, would do to somebody if he had Superman's powers. I think Siegel's father was murdered. Right. Well, and what happened with Siegel's father was, because I read the, you know, Matt Rizzuto's our friend, and he sent me his autopsy report of Jerry Siegel's dad. And in the autopsy report, it says something along the lines of heart attack during three Negroes robbing his store. And that's what it had written on this autopsy report. And those are the autopsy report's words, not mine. But that's what it had written in there. So it was definitely some act of crime was happening, and he and Jerry Siegel likely wanted revenge. You know, Gerard Jones, he wrote incorrectly that his dad was gunned down in a robbery as if he was Bruce Wayne's father, but that's not what happened. He had a heart attack during a robbery is what went down. And Jerry Siegel was angry, and that anger shows in those first 2 years of Superman when I read it.
Yeah, I mean, Superman had a political line. I don't think he was necessarily, you know, Republican or Democrat, but, you know, he had some kind of code or mission, you know, in those early years.
I would say he was an FDR almost socialist in those first 2 years before the war.
Of course, giving him Hitler to fight, I mean, it probably changed him completely at that point.
Well, it certainly made him more powerful.
Again, I just wanted to emphasize what Jim said, that, you know, this is not necessarily a typical Joe Shuster story that got printed in this book, but it is a wonderful one. It really emphasizes Schuster's strengths. So that's a good thing. Right. You know, before we run out of time on this, I want to get to this, like, because there's a couple of guys here that I know. Nice example of the Human Torch, which is, I guess, Carl Burgos. And a nice looking, you know, wonderful, pulpy, golden age artwork, but not ugly. I mean, except in a 1940s way. Right. Then we go down to the Flash origin. It's interesting to see any of these characters that actually, you know, that they made any good use of. Part of the deal is you deal with continuity that's getting up to 100 years. Some of these heroes are so set in the World War II era. That includes, like, the Fantastic Four, which they're rebooting right now, you know? I mean, you know, those guys were World War II vets. They knew Nick Fury. They wanted to fight the commies, the space race. Right. And that's all I'm really caring about on those guys. Wonderful, wonderful Flash origin. I think this is a, you know, a very well-drawn story by this guy, Harry Lambert. Do you guys know much? The Flash guy, Harry Lambert?
You mean the Golden Age Flash artist, Harry Lambert?
Yeah. That's, I don't know much about it. Did Kubert draw Flash or did Infantino draw Golden Age Flash?
Well, Infantino did draw some Golden Age Flash toward the end of its run. And then he, of course, drew the first of the Silver Age one. Yes.
So listen, when you get to the Green Lantern, I knew Martin O'Dell.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, cool.
And, well, you know, the deal about Marty is that I met him in maybe 1990, and he was sort of an older guy, and maybe that he'd come to back to comics late. Somebody said, you know, you could go and do these shows, you know, in your golden years. I think they were young enough that he and Carrie and O'Dell were traveling. And I feel like guys like, you know, a guy like Martin O'Dell, does he deserve a big fat check or not? You know, yes. I don't know. To see Martin O'Dell next to Julie Swartz, you can see where I love Julie to death, but he was still like the company man. So when he and Marty would be in a panel, that Julie, you know, might throw out some parameters, you know, to the conversation. I don't know that DC Comics is acknowledged Marty as a co-creator of the Green Lantern. And, you know, chances are it's probably a Bill Finger thing, and they just said, go draw it or something. I mean, that's not the way Marty tells it. You know, he said he went and thought about it. Maybe they had the name, the Green Lantern, and he, you know, visualized it. So look here, you have Alan Scott. By the way, he's wearing those pants I'm talking about, the Jodhpurs, that I'm going to buy some Jodhpurs. But there are some pretty panels here that Marty drew, you know, of like the guy making the evil Green Lantern. I think that looks pretty. And the crazy guy whose sanity is restored by the lantern. And so anyway, I don't know that every story I've seen by Martin O'Dell was as attractive as this one. But that's a nice looking story there, that Green Lantern origin story. Right.
And his costume is only in one panel. It's only that last panel
where
you actually see the costume.
And, you know, and I would say that Alan Scott is a character that's probably been, you know, ruined as they continue to reboot those characters, you know. I mean, if he ever was any, I mean, you know, that, I mean, this Golden Age Green Lantern, you know, with his wooden, you know, and he had, some of these guys ended up, in my mind, they ended up being negatively influenced by having those dumb comic sidekicks, you know.
Right, absolutely.
That's what Pfeiffer said.
Yeah, also, one last thing. Russ,
he didn't like that.
He didn't like the boy sidekicks. I'm talking about, like, you know, the Woozy Winks types, you know.
So the two quick things I want to interject there is the Green Lantern, probably more a Bill Finger thing. He was a pulp reader, and that was based on the Grey Lensman pulp series by E.E. Smith, who was also mentioned, actually, in that Astounding book. Then
I believe that, but, you know, Marty has his name. He signed the first story, you know. So.
Right. And then also, Russ Manning wrote a review on the Great Comic Heroes by Jules Pfeiffer. Russ Manning wrote that in a fanzine a year or so later, and he wrote that it was too depressing, nebbishy, and not a happy way of approaching those Golden Age characters, that Russ Manning feels like he would have approached it in a more lighter, happier sort of way than this neurotic East Coast approach that Pfeiffer took. So I just want to throw that out there, that in the Comic Book Historians Facebook group, if you search Russ Manning, Jules Pfeiffer, you'll see I posted that review up there. It's really interesting.
Hey, let me just comment one thing. If you're 11 years old, you probably didn't get to that, you know, erudite text
right.
for a year later. So And, you know, thank you, Russ Manning, but that book is still very important because the artwork is the bomb.
Yeah, that's great.
I want to add, I think the artwork's great. I wish that he'd been able to put a C.C. Beck more than just that one page in there. But for legal reasons, you still couldn't publish Captain Marvel at the time. So we only get a tiny glance at Beck's Captain Marvel during that period. But the two things that I would say is I'm a fan of the Pfeiffer stuff, and I disagree with any criticism of it. I love this text that he does. But one thing from just an interest point would be anyone that has seen or likes Tarantino's, what's the name of the movie, the Bride one?
Kill Bill.
Kill Bill. Kill Bill, the second, Kill Bill Part 2. Takes that speech directly from Pfeiffer, which I think is significant. A lot of people give the credit to Umberto Eco, but it's really Pfeiffer that says that Clark Kent is how Superman sees the rest of us. And it's in this book, in that chapter, that little thing about Superman, he talks about the whole notion of Clark Kent is how Superman sees the rest of humanity. And I think that's a fascinating, very smart point that comes directly from Pfeiffer. And then Tarantino uses it in that famous speech by Bill.
I believe that that's the great. Book is filled with quotable quotes, like when Pfeiffer says, if they'd given us a Wonder Woman with balls, we'd really have something to deal with, you know? I mean, you know, and we all pondered. I mean, this book really set a million kids on their destiny to be comic book historians.
I'm glad you pointed out Wonder Woman, though, because I think that's his biggest mistake is I don't think he understands Wonder Woman at all in this. He talks about it as being a group think that it's something that corporate came up with, which historically, as we know now, could not be farther from the truth. And Harry Peter is one of the more interesting artists of that national DC period. And I think he doesn't get that. Pfeiffer doesn't. But we should move on to me.
You know, but, you know, Wonder Woman is pretty much a golden age character. And I think when you get into that, that Andrew and Esposito era, it was just ugly. You know what I'm saying? I think that character was wasted for decades, you know, but I'll go with H.G. Peter.
And then, exactly. Peter.
Pfeiffer also calls Talkie Tawny a villain, which tells me that I don't think he really remembers Captain Marvel very well when he's doing this 20 years later.
Well, when you look at all kinds of heroes and they're like Plastic Man and you expect him to say something about it and he doesn't. I mean, he clearly had his premise and it was mainly that Superman was when you deal with those ragtag heroes that were thrown together in that era, you know, Superman is the zeitgeist, you know, and on to Jim.
Okay.
And Jim and I did talk a little bit about this before that he did miss the point of Marston's writing.
I wasn't invited to that meeting.
And the free open love of women and the bondage and the sororities that were in the Golden Age Wonder Woman. There's a lot of interesting panels that Pfeiffer could have touched upon, but did not. So
Maybe he shouldn't have, you know, I mean, again, when you deal with that book, this Pfeiffer book, as Jim sort of said, you know, it is what it is and it's brilliant, you know, and there we go. End of the story.
Right.
All right. So for my section, I'm going to do something a little bit different and try to keep it short because this is about thing that Alex and I are going to do on a semi-regular basis where we do these talking about reprinted books or archives or looking at the past in a different way than we usually do. I want to look at when you do reprints, when you do archives, one of the aspects is coloring or recoloring and the paper stock and what it is and how that takes you down an entirely different avenue. And the two main books I want to talk about would be both releases this year. One would be the re-release of the Topps Mike Mignola and Roy Thomas adaptation of Francis Ford Coppola's film Dracula in 1992. IDW republished it this year in black and white without the Mark Chiarella colors that I thought were brilliant at the time. And I want to talk about that for a minute. But this was the last work that Mignola did before he went to Hellboy. And it's when he's really starting to emerge at like the top of his game. And have you guys read this?
No, sir. No.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I did see the movie, so I have a little point of reference anyway.
Well, right. He captures it perfectly. And, you know, Mignola
it's a Mignola book. Yeah, I mean, so I was just commenting, well, it's a Mike Mignola book, and I love Mignola. And I do, I'm certainly sure that I, you know, saw the book in the stores at a time of the floppy release or whatever, how it came out.
I got it at the time and was just completely awed by just how it captures Coppola's cinematography and the pacing of the film. It's just a almost perfect adaptation, and comics rarely get that right. I can only think of a few that I really love, like Simonson's Aliens, but this one is great. And the coloring is just right by one of the best in the business, Mark Chiarella, who, on a side note, after 26 years, DC fired him just a couple of weeks ago, or retired him or let him go. And he was responsible. Do you guys know who he is? He was the editor, a visual editor at DC. He's responsible, came up with the idea of Batman Black and White, of the solo series that they did, of Wednesday Comics. He was the editor in charge of New Frontier. I mean, his body of work as somebody to get these projects done is amazing, and DC just got rid of him. But he's also on
reprint editions, right?
No. This was all his. These were all his. He was working on all of these projects. He greenlit and worked on all these projects.
I mean, I thought, and cut it out if I'm jumping to the point too fast, but, you know, I thought you were going to maybe talk about things like, let's say, DC Archives, where the books look radically different than the floppies, you know, when they'd recolored it and put it on that creamy stock and all that.
And that recoloring of the Kirby stuff. Yeah, no, that's for another podcast. This is...
Okay,
this
sorry.
So
that's just a taste of what's coming up here on Comic Book Historians.
The notion of this one is to take this book that's colored very, very well, and instead release it, IDW releases it in Mignola's black and white with no distraction of the color. It's like looking at one of those original art books, and it's fantastic, and it's on really nice white paper stock, and it's a beautiful book. And I think there's room, I would say, in that instance, in having both a color version, and sadly, there isn't one. That book hasn't been in print for 20 years,
They made an editorial decision to not put the color collection out.
That's correct.
They went with no color.
Or
pen and ink.
So it's pure Mignola, and I appreciate that. And it works in the genre, in the horror genre, and the way that it's done. Even though red is such a central color in terms of the original work, especially, you know, with the blood and such.
It's
and
so
yet
sanguine.
They take it out. And it's fantastic. I recommend it strongly, but in looking at it, it is a shame that you can't really cross-compare it with the original piece and how that was colored. The opposite of that, which takes place in the same year, is From Hell, where they are now currently releasing that as a colorized version. And so I wanted to compare that. What saves that, because I initially heard that and went nuts, but Eddie Campbell is doing it, the colors himself. He's using a very muted palette, except for bright reds every once in a while. And he talks about in interviews how it's only able to work because he's doing it on computer, where he has such a giant spectrum of watered down colors, and he can actually digitally remove the lines themselves and color them rather than simply painting over something on the art. So I think it's fascinating technology-wise, where you can do these new copies and do them in a way that allows for a different kind of impressionistic hues and things to the book. So we're in an interesting era where you can reprint and alter, and it be a positive thing in both of those instances, as long as you have access to both.
So From Hell, and is that an Alan Moore book?
Oh, yeah, that's Alan Moore's greatest book, in my opinion.
Originally a black and white book, and it's just now being colored?
Yes, it was all done in Eddie Campbell black and white, and was considered to be perfect as it was. And no one ever thought, well, let's colorize this. And it would be like colorizing Citizen Kane. But it's working because Eddie Campbell is doing it and doing it on the computer such that he can alter it. He's even making things, certain things, he's calling it clarity, color, and continuity. And so he's altering it a little bit, but not the way George Lucas totally screwed up Star Wars.
Okay, good analogy there. But look, we have to embrace the new technology. I mean, I think you can tell right now that comic book stores with the floppies, you know, the old books, there's economic problems with that. You know, Walmart and Target are about to take it over as like a remaindered thing, you know? So the future of comics is not in the floppies. The problem is that the floppies are like what is considered collectible, and that's still, that little engine is still driving it. But moving forward, you know, God, if they could take Joe Schuster artwork and make it into holograms, or you could spin it around 360 or whatever, bring it on.
Right.
You know? I mean, I think, you know, more is good. You know, I just assume, I mean, and I know as an artist, you don't always want to show your sketches, but there are a lot of these guys, you know, that, you know, as much as financially possible, I love the idea of the reinterpretation. You know,
it makes things a little fresh. I like looking at the old version and the new version most of the time.
Having said that,
I'll tell you, books at least,
the books that I bought, like the archives and Marvel Masterworks, really didn't look very good. They didn't have the same visceral feelings to me that the comics had. And I don't really have the money to buy the current books that are out there. Maybe they've got that right, that the books aren't as antiseptic, if you will, you know, as whatever, Superman Archives Volume 1, you know, where you've got that pulpy art contrasted with that museum printing.
I would rather read the Chronicles one that came out, the paperback Chronicles version, than the Archives one that you're talking about. Absolutely.
I think the Chronicles have a visceral punch that the Archives don't have.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, these things should never, you shouldn't get above your raisin, you know, and part of the deal was, I was too bad that they couldn't make inexpensive superhero movies. At one time, Wes Craven was going to direct the Batman movie, you know, and I thought that maybe that was the solution to things, because you look at movies like whatever, The Lone Ranger, you know, and these things where they take these pulpy things and then they try to make a $50 million movie out of it, and sometimes is just too much. I thought the whole point of the five-part book was that, you know, this is kind of lowbrow entertainment, or it was, you know, the music of the 60s, those were created for preteens, you know, and if we still love them as old, you know, senior citizens, well, fine. Listen, I feel like I was born at the right time. I am definitely a 20th century man, and thank you guys for having me on, because I revel in this stuff. This has been really a lot of fun to talk to you.
That's great. Yeah, well, I think pop culturally, I'm definitely a 20th century year old man too. Jim, although he is, but he also likes, he's always keeping his eye on the new stuff, and I respect.
Well, you
it.
Know,
I,
Kanye,
I don't have the same love for the new stuff as Jim does.
You know, Kanye West is a genius. You just have to understand him. So,
right, that whole yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Let me say, in terms of why this is happening, a little bit, I think it's interesting that the artist editions that have come out in the last 10 years has gotten us used to the notion of looking at them without color. And I think that the archive books that Larry's talking about that were so badly done in their recoloring or in their printing on that paper.
Or maybe censorship.
Yeah, there's more care now. And so like that Mignola book, Dracula, I think that's a byproduct of the success of the artist editions books, where we're looking at Kirby without the colors and really understanding how powerful that is.
Maybe, maybe, but it also may be, there may be a manga influence in the way that these books are coming out now, I think. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's an international sort of style to that, this idea of like those big black and white collections and stuff. I mean, that's what I think. I think they're supposed to resemble the Japanese collections.
And then Alex, for homework, when we do these sections, I want to ask the listeners to go on the Comic Book Historians Facebook page. Mm-hmm. In talking about coloring, the one that I'd like to hear some input on is the difference between the 1988 Killing Joke and the 2008 released Killing Joke in terms of coloring and the remastering. Because in the 1988 one, Bolin asked for the coloring to be black and white in the flashbacks, for it to be subtle and understated, And what John Higgins did was the exact opposite of that, with these garish, what Boland described as garish, hideous, glittering purple and pinks, that the flashbacks were all done in orange, that he envisioned the flashbacks being looking like Lynch's eraser head, and instead he got this thing that was radically different. And so when they did the 20th anniversary, he went back and he recolored it completely. And I'm curious which one people prefer, because for me, when you are exposed to that initial one, that's your version of the Killing Joke.
That's
so
right.
I enjoy the Higgins version, and I thought that the other one, while looking more like a 21st century, like a new, like a contemporary book, lost something in the translation. But I respect Boland for wanting to do it. So I'd like to hear from other people about what they thought about those two books.
I mean, to me, that sounds like that now you're into the George Lucas territory of, you know, really changing the work, not just putting color on it or something, you know.
Well, by the original
I feel that that first Star Wars, even though it's not as, doesn't look as pristine, I mean, that's clearly the, to me, that hits my heart, the initial Star Wars,
No, I mean, maybe. I mean, you know,
I think my son likes the newer stuff more because it's poppy and more cartoonish, right? And, whereas me, I like the dark edge, you know, I just see the arm of the monster and I can imagine the rest of it, you know, it's just different. There's almost something generational there.
One of the things, you know, you mentioned Star Wars and that's fine, but one of the things that's really interesting is how Paramount revised Star Trek. And in a lot of ways, they did the right decision by upgrading those special effects. I feel that if they want Star Trek to be in the public eye at all from the 1960s, they had to do something. Of course, the amazing thing is if you see Star Trek on HD, you see Leonard Nimoy's makeup line, and he has terrible acne, too, by the way. So that's that really is making Star Trek, which was the best that we had in 1976, puts it in an Ed Wood realm, you know, where it's beginning to look a little... It's because that the definition is so high, you know. So, but anyway...
That's funny, yeah. But, you know, I'm an Orville guy myself now, just so you know. I like the Orville more than Star Trek Discovery. Also, I'm going to throw that out there.
Well, Orville is definitely like a continuation of Star Trek TOS. And
it feels like you're watching the next generation, Star Trek Next Generation, right?
I mean, I feel like it's TOS, and I feel like this is such a, it's like a, like, you know, the Norwals or the computer wrote it, you know, by just combining all the old Gene Roddenberry Star Treks into a database and spitting out a script. Having said that, Orville is great. You know what I'm saying? It's just brain food.
It's a fun show. It's just, that's right.
But before this actually turns into a goodbye, everybody, can I say a thing or two, being the guest of the week?
Of course, please.
Sorry to you know, you can edit this like you actually asked me to do this in the podcast. Hey, so I want to talk to
you. I like to keep as much of the natural stuff as I can, actually.
That's fine. Yeah, let's not produce it or anything. But hello, everybody that's listening today. And, you know, my friend Don Mangus and, you know, the usual suspects and everybody else and the people from the Comic Book Historians Facebook page. I wanted to say hi to you. I appreciate Alex for inviting me on. I hope to do a streaming radio station pretty soon, and it's going to be pretty much involving like the music of the Beach Boys and specifically like the archival releases that they've released over the last 10 or 15 years. And they, you know, they remix Good Vibrations and Stereo and all kinds of stuff that even if you own those albums, I want to put it into sort of a radio station format, you know, where you have the excitement of having a curated playlist and there'll be some surf music on and a lot of new groups that are doing, you know, the whole point of my streaming service is to, it's really kind of embrace the fading lights of the 20th century. You know, the things that we're interested in are fading away. The sales of like Elvis or whatever are becoming smaller and smaller. You know, these things of the 20th century. The Beach Boys have little stronger legs because they write about the history of America and Western migration and the call of the Pacific Ocean, you know? So where a Beatles song is just, this, you know, Eleanor Rigby, you know, whatever. I mean, not to demean the Beatles, but I'm just saying the Beatles, if they're
there
about
goes it, the audition.
The Beatles. All right. The Beatles are about the 60s. The Beatles wrote the 60s, and they were in turn influenced by the 60s. But the Beach Boys is much more about the history of America. Okay. So I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. I see
moving
that.
Moving forward, they give the Beach Boys a certain legs that artists like Bob Dylan don't have moving forward because they put it in schools and stuff. So anyway, that's the radio station I'm going to do. You can certainly cut that for time, but I hope that, you know, comic book historians consider finding me on Facebook. I'd like you to consider friending me so that I can keep you informed about the things that I'll be doing. And I certainly hope to have Alex and Jim on the streaming station. What I want to do is right now, what I'm thinking about is playing these crazy songs about superheroes, whether it be, you know, Superman by R.E.M. or if you guys have heard those great things from the 60s. Have you ever heard the Dan and Dale album, the sensational guitars of Dan and Dale? Where they're doing the Batman theme and there's a Robin theme. And really, it's these great musicians, studio musicians that are just totally ad-libbing these songs about Batman. The songs I'm talking about by Dan and Dale, there's an album, some kind of album. You find it on Spotify. It's like, you know, the hits of DC Comics. If you've ever heard, like, there's a guy named Arthur, and he does a Metamorpho song and a Justice League song and a Plastic Man song.
That's cool.
You guys should definitely spin those because they're great. So I hope to have you guys on at some point, you know, some cross references. So I hope I haven't said too much.
Yeah, you should. No, that's great. You should talk. You know, Pete Coogan is a friend of ours. He's a professor in St. Louis, and he's been on the show a few times. And he knows a lot of these esoteric superhero songs. Like, there's one that's like this Harlem or Motown version of a Captain Marvel song that he was singing to me one time. You guys would have a good conversation about that, actually.
Well, I think the idea of, you know, finding the long list of songs about superheroes, you know, and they could be a continuing thing. Because I want to do podcasts, but I also think that there is an immediacy to saying it's live, you know, like your show. You say, well, you know, if you dial in at noon, we're on, you know, I mean, we'll see if that philosophy is true or not, you know, but it's sort of like the thing that you'll watch whatever's on TV. So you see Goodfellas every day, as opposed to putting in a DVD or something, you know, from off the shelf. You're too lazy to do that, you know? So anyway, I think there's an urgency to streaming. My radio station will be the best radio station in the world. And for the devotees of, you know, James Bond and surf music and the Tarantino movies and the moon landing, we're going to try to shoehorn all that into a radio format. And it's just a question if anybody wants a radio station in 2019, you know, as opposed to just having your Spotify playlist, which is great too. So Alex, if you wonder why I'm so weird, that's why.
Okay. So thanks again, everybody, for another great episode of the Comic Book Historian Podcast. Not only did we talk about comic books, but it looks like today we went through the fields of pulps, music, movies, etc. Thanks, Jim, for joining us today. And also, Larry W. King, Larry Wayne King, you were fantastic today. Thanks so much. I'm excited about you coming on. If you ever have time for a future episode, we'd always love to have you back. And thanks again for listening, everybody.